speak. So I'll be talking about, I think I gave a different title. I think I gave the title Black Holes Beyond Astrophysics, and then I wrote the talk and realized that this is a more appropriate title. Maybe Novel Black Hole Physics and Numerics. So I was very wise to not put the word numerics in when the talk was advertised, because I understand that people who do fundamental things don't always like computers very much. But so what I hope to talk about is some applications of black hole physics to various forms of phenomenology which aren't the usual one that you're used to, i.e. black holes and astrophysics in our universe as we know it in four-dimensional GR. And because it's a huge subject, I want to take a rather personal perspective and talk. I'll talk rather generally about some things, but I also want to mention some of the work I've been involved in. And one of the themes, I think, is that numerical techniques provide a sort of window into answering questions that we might like to know the answer to, and seem to be increasingly important in this in these sort of novel fields looking at black holes. And so some of the work I'll mention will be with various collaborators. Yeah. So a plan for the talk. I'll talk briefly, very briefly, about four-dimensional black holes, because I'm sure you're all very familiar with four-dimensional black holes. And I'll just make a distinction between sort of what you can do analytically and what you can do numerically. And then I'm going to move on to what is more novel black hole physics. And as I say, it's a huge area, and it probably means different things to different people. So I thought I'd focus on three topics of novel black hole physics. And these are topics which are sort of relevant for phenomenology in various arenas. There's also a huge study of black holes in the context, for example, of string theory, very formal aspects of black holes, for example, counting entropy of black holes and so on. And there's lots of novel physics there, but I won't be talking about that today. So the first sort of novel area is on its way to being ruled out. So it's just it's probably one of the last talks I'll be able to give on it. And that's the idea that black holes might be produced at colliders, maybe LHC or indeed future colliders, if there are large extra dimensions. And this is a sort of interesting and historically was a very interesting motivation for thinking about what black holes do when there are extra dimensions. And so what I'm then going to talk about is what black holes do when there are extra dimensions. And as we'll see, the story is very complicated. Black holes are very complicated, more than four dimensions. I'll start by talking about what happens if you have extra dimensions that are compact, so they have a finite volume, finite size, and we'll see that really is complicated, terribly, terribly complicated. And in fact, numerical methods seem to be key in elucidating the black hole solutions there. And then we'll move on to the case where they're not compact, where extra dimensions are asymptotically flat. They're very large, so the black holes are much smaller. And there, things are probably even more, they're just as complicated in different ways. But there's a little bit more analytic progress, although that leads to some rather surprising and exotic results. So there's a very exotic phenomenology of these black holes that's in some sense still has to be understood. I'll then move on to a different topic, which is exotic gravity theories. Now, there are by now many different exotic gravity theories on the market. Some try to explain dark energy or dark matter, and some just try to extend Einstein's theory of gravity just as a sort of way of testing how much we've really tested Einstein's theory of gravity. And there are some beautiful theories. One of them, I'll just talk a little bit about work in the Randall syndrome model, because one of the points with these exotic theories of gravity is we might understand them in the weak gravitational limit, but rather little is understood in the strong field limit. So, namely, when we're talking about black holes. And black holes might provide an important window to test these theories, and not that much is known about, again, black holes in these sort of theories. And the Randall syndrome model was precisely an example where not much was known, And again, numerics provide a window into answering these questions. And then I want to talk about something completely different, assuming I'll still have time to do that, and that's the context of ADS-CFT. Because these two categories here you know, we may just live in a world where all of gravity can be described classically only by Einstein's theory, and to go beyond that, you really need a quantum theory or something that doesn't look anything like geometry, just extra dimensions or exotic gravity. So these are very speculative topics. ADS-CFT provides a very new arena, a very important arena, where novel black hole physics becomes related to properties of quantum field theory. So ADS-CFT, maybe I should just ask you to put your hands up, a show of hands. How many people know what ADS-CFT is here? Just so I mean, obviously, various people. Okay, so I'm going to assume. Okay, so far from everyone. So I'll talk about what it is. But it's a very interesting arena where certain quantum field theories are related to certain theories of gravity. They're thought to be physically equivalent, and black holes play a very interesting role in this equivalence. So black holes in the quantum in the gravitational side of this correspondence correspond, as I'll explain later, to regions of the field theory where you've heated it up. You've basically given it temperature. You've pulled plasma out of the vacuum, if you like. And in this context, for example, studying the different types of black hole solutions, these are rather exotic gravitational theories. So there are all sorts of exotic black holes to study, just like there are here. And also the dynamics of these black holes can be rather rich and complicated. And I'll talk about an example of that, some work in progress at the moment. But of course, one point to emphasize is that assuming we don't see large extra dimensions of LHC and there is no exotic gravity, this probably provides the most powerful motivation for thinking about novel black hole physics as a tool to understanding various quantum field theories. So conventional black hole physics, as you all know, we have great analytic control of vacuum solutions when we don't have matter and we just want equilibrium solutions. We know the static black hole is the Schwarzschild solution that's been known for since 1918. And the Kerr solution, which describes the rotating black hole, is known explicitly, which is actually, when you look at the Kerr solution, remarkable. And when you look at the equations that it solves, even more remarkable. So it's not surprising that it took till the 1970s to discover this solution. But we also know through powerful uniqueness theorems that the Kerr solution is the only solution allowed. So if you're talking about vacuum and equilibrium solutions, we know everything analytically, which is a wonderful situation to be in. And as we know, black holes really, in our world, describe stellar collapse and all the collapse of cold dark matter. Now, including matter or going out of equilibrium, typically one has to resort to numerics. For example, if you want to consider stars, neutron stars, relativistic neutron stars, that's an old story where these solutions are axisymmetric if the star's rotating. And so you can reduce the problem because it's stationary and it's axisymmetric. You can reduce it to a problem depending only on two coordinates. And this is a classic elliptic PDE problem, which numerically people solved many years ago. And so this is a nice story there, and it's essentially all done. Spherical dynamical collapse, likewise, it's a beautiful story. Turns into a 1+1 PDE system. You've got time and a radial dependence in your PDEs. You can see very clearly that if you start with enough matter, you get dynamical collapse. There are interesting critical phenomena. But modulo that story is very well understood in conventional GR and is all done. And beyond these sort of very simple applications of numerics, one has to go to the full dynamical GR, which is 1+3-dimensional PDEs, possibly with matter, which makes things even harder. And that, I think it's safe to say, probably isn't done yet. And it's extremely hard. And there are some experts in the audience. Franz Pretorius, for example, was one of the people who made real progress in this. There's a huge step in progress a number of years ago now, where finally people could simulate binary black hole systems, and presumably soon we'll be able to. Well, I don't know what the state of the art now is with matter as well, but I mean, these simulations are absolutely critical for understanding how to see what gravity wave signals one expects the gravity wave experiments to see, and therefore to be able to dig them out of the noise. So this, but I want to emphasize that these sorts of simulations are orders of magnitude harder than these sort of simulations, which is why it took decades for them to be done. But in 4D, we know a lot analytically. The type of black holes are known analytically, very simply. And the sort of simple numerics has all been done decades ago, and the rest is very hard. And that's somewhat in contrast to these novel topics, where we know relatively little analytically, but relatively simple numerical problems can actually yield quite a lot of interesting results. So they're interesting open areas if you're willing to get your hands a little bit dirty, but don't have a supercomputer to play with. So let me talk about this first topic, large compact extra dimensions and the LHC. So as many of you will have heard, extra dimensions were proposed an awfully long time ago in the 1920s, which is remarkable in itself, by Kaluza and Klein. And modern string theory, as you probably know, relies on many extra dimensions. So we might pictorially represent these extra dimensions by writing R four dimensions, sort of suppressing them in just this up direction and the out of board direction. And then all the other extra dimensions I'm just going to write as this direction normal to these planes. And then I'm going to ask you to think about identifying points in this plane with this plane. So this will make this direction here compact into a circle. And obviously, I can only draw one dimension this way. But one should really imagine more complicated situations where the geometry is something like our four-dimensional space, and then the extra dimensions take the form maybe of some complicated geometry that we're not going to worry too much about here. So as I say, you identify this point with this point, this point with this point, and this then becomes sort of compact manifold M. And it's got some characteristic length scale, let's call it L. And naively, you would imagine you should take L to be very small. So of course, we know that matter, we know how matter interacts very precisely from LEP and LHC and so on, previous experiments. And we've measured it down to fairly near the TeV scale. And we don't see extra dimensions by looking at matter, particle physics behavior, standard model. But Akani, Hamed, Demopoulos, and Diwali understood, or made the very interesting observation, I think, that if your matter is confined to some surface in these extra dimensions, a 1 plus 3 dimensional surface, you can't then use matter to test for the existence of extra dimensions. You have to use gravity as the probe, because it's only the gravity, if your matter is all confined in the surface, it's only the gravity that sees the extra dimensions, the geometry. And so the only probe is things like the simplest probe is to sort of check the force law between two gravitating objects. Do you see a 1 over r potential, as you would expect in four dimensions, or some other power? And when you start to think about how experimentally constrained that is, actually, it's not very constrained at all, because it's, of course, very difficult to measure the gravitational pull between two objects that are small enough that you can put their center of masses within a millimeter of each other or of that order. So in fact, extra dimensions, pushing beyond sort of fractions of a millimeter is pretty much the limit in terms of what is the size of these extra dimensions could be. So they could be, I think it's very peculiar that you could measure with a ruler almost better where you are in R4 dimensions than where you would be in the extra dimension in this sort of scenario. It's very surprising. Now, the fundamental Planck scale is then not the Planck scale of four dimensions, which we know is 10 to the 19 gigaelectron volts, some huge number. But if you then think about the actual gravity theory being higher dimensional, then the fundamental scale that governs when quantum gravity effects become strong is then actually diluted by the size of the extra dimensions when you work it out. So if you're in D dimensions, this is the formula. And so Akani, Hamed, Demopoulos, and Diwali said, why don't we get rid of the hierarchy problem, which is namely the fact that the four-dimensional fundamental gravity scale is so enormously higher than the weak scale of the standard model, and why don't we instead choose the fundamental scale to be the TeV scale, the particle physics scale, the Higgs scale, and instead solve the hierarchy problem by requiring the extra dimensions to be very large. And in fact, you require more than one extra dimension. You require at least two. And for example, if you have two extra dimensions, they have to be a micron in size in order to arrange the fundamental scale to be TeV and our four-dimensional scale to be 10 to the 19 GeV. Whereas if you go to more extra dimensions, they can be smaller, but always much, much bigger than TeV scale. So it's a very strange sort of scenario. Very interesting, though, because when you have this low fundamental scale, as Giddings and Thomas pointed out, if you collide fundamental particles together with center of mass energies greater than this fundamental scale, and if your fundamental scale is around TeV, then that's precisely what LHC is going to do, then you could create a black hole. And the reason being that the Compton wavelength of the product goes down as you increase the mass of the center of mass energy, but the black hole radius, the Schwarzschild radius, grows with the energy. So normally when we think about an electron, its Compton wavelength is vastly bigger than its Schwarzschild radius, its black hole radius. So you can't think of it as classically, think of it in any classical way, so there's no way it could be described by a black hole. But if you pump the energy enough, that stops happening. So one of the surprising things is if in LHC this sort of scenario is correct, you would bang together your matter. And whilst you don't really know what's going on in your fundamental theory, it may be very complicated, provided you have enough energy, it's all shielded by this horizon of a black hole. And actually, the more energy you put in fact, the lower the energies that you're sort of directly probing, because the horizon shields more and more of what's going on inside. Very surprising. So it's also true that if you create one of these black holes, you collide some matter, the signature it would have in LHC is very distinctive, because the black hole would then Hawking radiate away. It's an isotropic and very soft process compared to the other sort of processes you have in a collider like this. Now, if the extra dimensions then are very large and you form TeV-sized black holes at LHC, the black holes are basically going to live in this very asymptotically flat. They're not going to care about the size of the extra dimension. They're just going to think they're infinite. And so effectively, you're seeing some higher dimensional, what we call asymptotically flat space. But if some of the dimensions are fundamental scale and some of them are large, then the black holes produced may see some compact extra dimensions and some large dimensions. So it has to see more than five large dimensions. And so with that as sort of motivation, I'm now going to talk about what happens when you think about what black holes do in more than four dimensions. So I'll start by talking about static black holes, and for that I'm going to talk about compact extra dimensions, and then I'm going to talk about rotating black holes, and for that I'm going to talk about asymptotically flat extra dimensions. And if you've not heard this before, you might find it somewhat surprising how complicated the story is. So let's think about compact extra dimensions. So just because it'll be complicated enough, we'll just think about the simplest model, the original Kaluza-Klein model, where we have one extra dimension and it's just a circle. So we want to consider geometries that asymptote to our four-dimensional space in a circle. Now, there are two obvious types of black hole solution in this theory. One of them is very simple. You just take the usual four-dimensional static Schwarzschild solution. It can have any radius you like, and you just add on the extra circle, and that still solves all the equations. And pictorially, it looks like this. The horizon of the black hole just uniformly or homogeneously wraps over this circle direction. So we call this a homogeneous black string. And I haven't drawn it here, but this can have any radius compared to this size, because we can just dial the radius of this Schwarzschild solution. Now, on the other hand, there's a completely different type of black hole. When the mass of the black hole is rather small, of course, it doesn't care that it's in a compact dimension, and it's just going to look like a higher dimensional black hole. It's going to look essentially like a 5D Schwarzschild solution in the limit where it becomes small. So already we see two different types of black hole solution. This one is trivial to write down analytically. This one we can only describe in some perturbative limit where it becomes small. So already there's a class of black holes here we don't know how to describe analytically, which is sort of slightly depressing. But matters get even worse because of the Gregor-Laflamme instability. So I don't know if Raymond Laflamme is here, but before he went into quantum theory, he discovered that these uniform or homogeneous strings, when they're big compared to this size L, they're stable, but they're actually unstable when you try to make them too small. It's very similar to putting a water droplet between two plates. If you put the plates close enough together, the water droplet just sits there between the two plates, stretching between them, and it's very happy. But if you try to separate them, then the droplet at some point becomes unstable and wants to localize itself on the two plates. It's exactly, I mean, Cardoso and Oscar Diaz showed very nicely that this is a beautiful analogy. Now, at precisely the point where this instability is marginal, as Gregory Laflamme pointed out, you can sort of poke this solution by the marginal perturbation, and it's static. That's what we mean by a marginal perturbation. And that precisely signals that there's a new branch of solutions. That new branch of solutions looks like this. So if you just poke this marginal solution, you can sort of poke it by different amounts, and you go off along a new branch called the inhomogeneous black strings. So this instability wants to, at least like with the water droplet, it wants to break the translational invariance on this circle. It doesn't want to be thin like this. It wants to do something else. And so these solutions, the horizon is inhomogeneous. It depends on the circle. These have a rather complicated geometry. So here's a new class of black hole. Same topology horizon as these uniform homogeneous strings, but again, not analytically known. And in fact, Barrett Cole then proposed that these localized solutions and these inhomogeneous solutions are actually continuously connected to each other. If you sort of pump up the mass, it's not quite that simple, but pump up the mass of this solution, at some point it will meet itself, meet its images, and then there'll be a topology change and it will go through to this new type of solution. So it's rather speculative, but we'd then like to be able to test to see whether that's true or not. So of course, as I said, we don't have any analytic control. We have to resort to some numerics, and it's not completely trivial to do that. We know, for example, in electrostatics, when you look at a static problem, things should reduce to an elliptic set of PDEs, essentially the Poisson equation. And what one has to do with gravity is massage the equations into an elliptic form where you can use methods that you understand. And the way we do this, there are different ways to do it, but I think the way that in the last few years we've been using and seems to be rather effective is to add gauge fixing terms to the equations. These get rid of the what's called the diffeomorphism invariance, or the coordinate invariance of the geometry that GR is based on. The problem is, if you don't get rid of the coordinate invariance, there isn't a solution, there's a family of solutions related by coordinate transformations. And so you have to get rid of that freedom. You do it by adding gauge fixing terms, and then you have to understand that the solution to the equations that you're solving, which are the Einstein equations plus gauge fixing terms, really give you solutions to the Einstein equations that you wanted in some sensible coordinate system. You use the isometries as much as you can to reduce the effective dimension of the problem. But at the end of the day, you can find solutions. Here's a rather fanciful. This is actually real data. They're not actually shiny, I should say, obviously. It's tautological to have shiny black holes. There we are. So this is real data. You find these solutions. Here are the localized solutions down here. They have an exposed axis of symmetry. If you recall, as the axis of symmetry here of the solution is exposed. So I'm just depicting that to show you how long it is. These are proper embeddings of the geometry of the numerical horizons that you find. And you do indeed find that as you can move along this branch of localized solutions, it becomes bigger, it sort of spreads out, and then does indeed seem to transition in topology to these inhomogeneous string solutions, which then become more and more homogeneous and end at the homogeneous string branch. I haven't drawn the homogeneous strings, but of course there's a family of them.
Is there a physical sort of effect associated with this topology change? Some release of radiation, or
indeed, Barrett Cole has thought about that sort of thing and claims, yeah. I mean, you would have to have a physical situation where this happened.
Do you see something like that in the numerics?
So I should emphasize that what we're finding is static solutions.
Okay, so you don't see.
So indeed, this is not time in any sense. This is a sequence of static solutions. That's right. And I won't bore you with more details, much as I'd love to, but you can compute various properties as a solution, area against mass, and so on. And indeed, so for example, if we look here, these localized solutions, as we make them bigger, they reach a maximum mass. This is mass against area. they reach a maximum mass, then in fact they come down in mass, they go through this topology change here, through to these inhomogeneous strings, and reach this point of marginal stability on this branch, which is the homogeneous strings. That continues to very high mass. Obviously, one of the things we see that we probably should have expected is that at high mass, it's the homogeneous string solution that dominates. And because that's just a product of the 4D Schwarzschild solution with the extra dimension, its behavior is just that of 4D Schwarzschild, which is good. I mean, well, which is good or bad, depending on your point of view. But it does mean that if you're looking at an astrophysical black hole in this sort of theory, it would be of that variety and would have the usual 4D physics you would imagine. Now, let's look at asymptotically flat, because we saw in the compact case, even static solutions are a bit of a disaster, very complicated. It's slightly better in the asymptotically flat case, and that, from the point of view of collider physics, is probably the more natural option, at least if there were extra dimensions and you could see them in LHC. I mean, with the energies LHC has, this would be the situation where you could describe things gravitationally using classical gravity. So the static solution in higher dimensions is a simple generalization of the Schwarzschild solution, and it's known to be unique. There's nice work of Shiramitsu and people who showed this. The Kerr solution has a relatively simple generalization, depending on whether you think the Kerr solution itself is simple, called the Myers-Perry solution. That was by Rob Myers. However, there's no uniqueness theorem. There's no theorem saying that's the only solution. And indeed, Roberto Imparin, who's here, and Harvey Rial made the remarkable discovery that not only do you have this generalization of Kerr, the Myers-Perry solution, but in five dimensions, they also found a completely new type of black hole called the black ring. And it doesn't have an ellipsoidal horizon. It has a ring-like horizon. This is an S2, a two-sphere, and there's, so it's an S2 cross a circle, and the momentum in this original solution is going around in the circle. So it's a very, very bizarre black hole solution. And in fact, even more bizarre solutions were then later found. For example, the black Saturn, where you have a black ring rotating around a sort of ellipsoidal Myers-Perry-like solution in the middle. And it gets very complicated. In fact, beyond five dimensions, work of people like Roberto suggest where you can understand in certain limits, perturbative limits, these black holes. Work suggests that black rings should still exist and these black Saturns should still exist and so on, but we don't know them analytically, and there's sort of reason to believe the situation is the number of symmetries you have is less, and so probably we'll never know them analytically. And in fact, beyond five dimensions where we don't know these black ring solutions, the situation is slightly more complicated because this Myers-Perry solution, you can spin it as much as you like. In five dimensions, there's an upper bound to the spin, but in six dimensions or above, you can spin it as much as you like, and it becomes rather flat. And it's rather natural to think if you have an object and you can spin it as much as you like, it's just going to want to fall apart at some point. That's a rather natural thing. And in fact, Rob Myers and Roberto showed that, in fact, there's an analog of this instability of the black strings we were talking about early, with this sort of fluid-like instability where it wants to break into droplets, would happen here. And so the conjecture is beyond five dimensions. You have a very, this is work of Roberto and collaborators, a very complicated structure of solutions for the stationary ones. Here's a plot of area of the solution against angular momentum, just turning on single angular momentum for fixed mass. This black curve here is the Myers-Perry solutions, which we know. Work of Oscar Diaz, who's here, George Santos, who's here, and others, showed that there are marginal instability points of the type envisioned by Roberto when you spin this too fast. And just like in the static solutions within the compact dimension that we saw earlier, these marginal stability points sort of give birth to new branches of solutions where the Myers-Perry solution, which is sort of roughly ellipsoidal, gets deformed into something that wants, in some sense, to break it into droplets. So here it gets deformed, it gets pinched, and the idea then is it goes through a topology change, just like these black strings did, and then here turns into the black ring solutions. So it pinches down, that pinches off, and you join to the black rings. which we don't know analytically. So almost none of this we know analytically. The only thing we know is this curve here. Recently, in fact, people have constructed, very recently in the last week, people have constructed these black rings in six dimensions, and it seems to agree with this picture. In fact, there are higher instabilities, which are then thought to join up to the black Saturns and more complicated solutions. But you can see it's a very, very weird structure. The key question then is, are these stable or are they unstable? So we know that the Myers-Perry solution, this black, solid black curve, is unstable past here, at least. And probably black rings, so on, certainly when they're spinning a lot, are unstable. But it's a very hard question to answer. There was very beautiful work by Shibata, who's here, and Yoshino, showing that, in fact, the Myers-Perry solution is indeed unstable when you spin it too much, but in fact not to this instability, but to an instability that's more important. It kicks in down here somewhere. And it's an instability that essentially wants to stop it rotating so fast. So it's a rather natural instability. But as for the other solutions in there, we haven't even constructed them yet, let alone understand their stability. And so there's, you know, it's a very complicated situation. In terms of actually making links to collider physics, to take that seriously, Cardoso and his group have talked about simulations of head-on collisions of black holes. Now, that's a numerical problem that's in a harder class. That's a sort of more like the full numerical simulations one does in astrophysics of GR. It requires, there's little symmetry, and you have to do very serious computation. Likewise, Lewis Lerner, who's here, and Franz Pretorius have also looked at the dynamics of this Gregory-Laflamme instability, what it does when something goes unstable, which potentially, again, might be interesting if you were taking collider physics seriously. Again, that's very, very nice numerical work, but these are orders of magnitude harder. So I hope I've convinced you that black holes have a very exotic phenomenology when you go beyond standard four dimensions. And in this context, looking at asymptotic flat ones or compact ones, it's a very interesting structure, but analytically one's very limited. And developing new tools to study them is sort of crucial, and they're probably going to be numerical. Now, I just want to talk more briefly about what I might call exotic gravity theories. These are, again, speculative. There are all sorts of them. There's the old sort of Brans-Dickey scalar tensor theories, Einstein ether theory of Jacobson, the Tevez theory of Bekenstein, which is designed to explain dark matter. And then there are theories with extra dimensions that are sort of weird. They're not compact extra dimensions, such as DGP or the Randall syndrome model. And all of these things, all of these models, one has quite a lot of control in the weak field, and one can understand that you reproduce conventional 4D GR results. So you don't rule out the theories just based on solar system tests, for example. But very little is known in any of these theories about what black holes do. And so it's a really an open question whether black holes can rule out some of these theories. So black holes now, it's not something we're going to produce in a collider. It's really, they're potentially a tool. We know they exist in astrophysics, and it's potentially a tool to try and constrain these theories or even rule them out. And I just want to talk about one of these models, the Randall syndrome model, just because there's been some progress on that recently, where there was a claim that one might be able to constrain the theory based on black holes. I'm not going to tell you in detail what the Randall syndrome model is. It's a somewhat strange model. It involves one of these surfaces, these brains, that matter is localized on, and then there's some one extra direction. It has a strange geometry, an anti-de Sitter geometry, which is the sort of geometry you have when you have a negative cosmological constant here with a length scale little l, but it's not compact. There's an infinite distance away from this brain. It's somewhat remarkable because the claim is if you localize your matter on this surface and look at the gravitational response of the geometry of this brain, the surface, it precisely reproduces assuming you're looking at low-energy matter on scales compared to L, it precisely reproduces the predictions of 4G GR in the weak field limit. So the propagator, for example, goes like 1 over R, as you would expect. There are corrections to it, and they're power law corrections, interestingly, rather than the sort of exponentially suppressed corrections you would expect if you had compact extra dimensions. So it's something very different. The mechanism for why you recover 4D gravity is very different. But there was then a wonderful claim by Tanaka and Roberto Emparan and collaborators a sort of a decade ago now, that this inequality is the wrong way around, that for black holes that are large compared to L, size L, there were no static solutions. You couldn't have a static black hole. And these were based on very plausible arguments relating to ADS-CFT and so on. And phenomenologically, the time scale of time dependence, if you had if you sort of developed a horizon, the time scale for its time dependence would have to go like this. So if you were looking at a solar mass black hole and L was of order a millimeter or just under a millimeter, the time scale would be of order years. And you can see that we know there are black holes out there that have been around for much longer than a year. And so this strongly constrains the theory. And it's very interesting then to have a theory that's constrained by thinking about black hole physics rather than by thinking about just the force law in the weak field limit. So here's a little picture. Here's this conjecture. There's a black hole. It sort of extends off in this extra direction. And it's always got to somehow be dynamical. There was it's a numerical problem. And there was numerical work. And in fact, there was numerical work essentially supporting the fact that no solutions existed. But I think more recently, we've used maybe more advanced numerical methods, or at least we've done things a different way. And we can indeed answer this problem. So we have indeed found these black hole solutions. They look, if you want a picture of them, this isn't real data, but it looks like this without this. So they do seem to exist statically. And they do exactly what you might expect. So they have a 5D behavior at low small sizes. And when you make them large, they transition to a 4D behavior rather smoothly, which is sad because you then can't rule out this model. But this is just one of the exotic models. It's still somewhat mysterious that this all works out so nicely. I mean, it's not that mysterious. There's sort of more understanding of it now. But one can do a very good numerical job and convince yourself that indeed these solutions exist.
Is there a physical reason to understand simply why there is a static solution, or is that complicated and very numerical?
It's probably best left for after. Okay. You have to understand why one would claim there isn't a static solution before one then claims one can understand why there is. But another maybe more interesting example is the Einstein ether theory. Now, I don't have any results for this. I would love to be showing you results, but I have none, and I haven't done any work on it. But here's another example of an exotic theory. It has a vector field that defines the ether everywhere in space. And in this theory, it's a wonderful theory. It's a it actually allows you to have a two-parameter theory. Oh, fantastic. A two-parameter theory that deforms Einstein's theory, but is still compatible with all the solar system tests and so on. But the black holes seem to be rather different. So in particular, if you look at a static black hole, there's no analytic solution for it. It's rather complicated. It's still it's only a one-dimensional problem. It's simple to do. But the ether field has some rather complicated behavior outside the black hole. And if you wanted to look at rotating solutions, they would really be much more complicated. Or indeed, a black hole that moves through the ether. That would also be deformed away from the usual Kerr solution. And these things, you know, these black holes may provide a new window to test this theory. So again, not analytic. We would need to use numerical methods to find them. The situation becomes even more complex in theories like Tevis or other modified gravity theories. So there's really, it's sort of an entirely new arena where little work has been done. So in the last 15 minutes, I want to then talk about ADS-CFT. So if one isn't interested in real-world phenomenology, or one doesn't believe there's anything other than Einstein gravity, then this really is your motivation for thinking about novel black hole physics. So what is ADS-CFT? It's rather remarkable. It's a conjecture, but I think it's fair to say at this point it's almost certainly true. It's very difficult to understand how it couldn't be true by now. It states that certain, and I would say rather special, quantum field theories are supposed to be physically equivalent to certain, rather often, rather special, gravitational theories. By gravitational theories, really for the purposes of this talk, let's just say string theories that have gravity in them in some limit. And one of the key points here, or for the purpose of this talk, at least just to make things simple, is that these gravitational theories aren't posed in sort of four-dimensional flat asymptotic spaces we usually think about, but in rather exotic spaces like ADS. So they have to have rather exotic asymptotics, and they have cosmological constants or other matter to make that consistent. Now, the case where this correspondence is understood best is in a four-dimensional supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, which is, it's very similar to QCD. I mean, it's Yang-Mills theory in four dimensions, and it's just that the fermionic matter is arranged with some other scalar matter to make the theory supersymmetric. But it's not, you know, it really isn't a million miles away from QCD. Now, this quantum field theory, it's actually a conformal field theory, which is where the CFT comes from in ADS-CFT, although that isn't so important. This quantum field theory is thought to be equivalent to a very particular closed string theory, which includes gravity in it. And there's a very particular relation between the parameters, the Yang-Mills coupling in the Yang-Mills theory and the number of colors n with the string coupling in the string theory and the string length, which sets the tension of the strings. And the vacuum geometry is involved in one of these anti-de Sitter spaces. Also, there's a five sphere, which just sort of, in some sense, goes along for the ride. You can think of it as some compact extra dimensions as well as your ADS space. Now, this closed string theory reduces to something tractable that we understand in the limit that you make the number of colors large and the relevant coupling for perturbation theory in the field theory, the so-called TUF coupling, large as well. So this is the so-called TUF limit, the large n limit, and we need to make the coupling in the field theory rather large. Now, I should say, you might be confused by that, but because this is a conformal field theory, you can tune the coupling. The coupling is marginal. You can make it whatever you like. Okay. Now, you know, this then is a simple theory, but because it's a strong coupling, in order for the string theory to reduce to something that looks more like gravity, because the field theory then is a strong coupling, it's still rather complicated. It's not something you can just solve in perturbation theory. And beyond perturbation theory, one is quite limited in what one can do with strongly coupled field theories. But nonetheless, it's a theory you can write down. It's perfectly well defined. You can, in principle, people are now trying to put these things on the lattice, the Monte Carlo simulate them, people are working very hard to try and solve these sort of theories. But the important point is, whatever it is, it's well defined, and it's apparently physically equivalent to some gravitational theory in this limit. Now, one direction in ADS-CFT, in some sense fundamentally the most interesting direction, is to try and understand, it's a quantum correspondence. We're really saying these two theories are exactly the same, quantum mechanically. And in some sense, the most interesting thing is to try and understand quantum gravity by working with this quantum field theory, this conformal field theory. Now, so any question you want to know about quantum gravity in some sense is encoded in this quantum field theory, but it's strongly coupled. So this is people are trying to do this, but it's very hard. But a very interesting and something that's had a lot of interesting results recently is to sort of reverse the logic and say, well, actually, since this quantum field theory is strongly coupled, we do understand certain things about gravity. For example, we understand black holes very well and what they do. We have a lot of intuition for them. And so actually you can reverse the logic and say, well, why don't we try and learn about these strongly coupled quantum field theories, which we know so little about by thinking straight from quantum field theory, by thinking about what happens in gravity. And this may sound somewhat surprising, but I think it's very important to realize that in instances where you have this correspondence between a gravitational theory and a quantum field theory, the quantum field theory is rather special. So in some sense, the degrees of freedom in it split into a sort of two sets, one set which lift up to very high energies and one set which sort of stay at low energies. And it's this low energy set that you can describe. It has this nice dual description in terms of a gravity theory. And the high energy stuff, provided you work at low enough energies, you can ignore consistently. In most quantum field theories, you don't have anything like that structure. And that's why this is working. So, It's sort of very cunning. Now, let me just, again, take a sort of personal route through this. An awful lot of stuff has been done. There's not a lot to say about black holes and AdS-CFT. And I just want to tell you about one example where some relatively simple numerics can, in principle, get hopefully some sort of interesting results. The vacuum geometry of the gravitational theory is anti-de Sitter space. It's written like this. There's this cosmological constant, again, negative, with this scale L. And the important thing about anti-de Sitter space, it's a little bit like a box. It has a boundary. And that boundary, as I've written it here, the geometry of the boundary is Minkowski space. So that boundary in the z-coordinate, as you can see, is z is 0. So there are some coordinates x in the boundary here. And then there's a radial coordinate, let's call it z, that goes away from the boundary. And the sort of law in AdS-CFT is that the closer you are to the boundary, the physics that's happening there is equivalent to very high energy physics in the field theory. The physics that's happening down here is equivalent to low energy physics. So this radial coordinate sort of geometrizes energy scale in some sense. And the way the correspondence works, one of the key things that sort of ways it works is that every field in the interior here is paired with an operator in the field theory. Now the field theory, I should have said, I think I forgot to say, the field theory you should think of as living on the geometry of the boundary here. So it lives in less dimensions than this gravitational theory, and so this is often called holography, meaning that somehow, miraculously, this field theory is managing to encode the information about a higher dimensional theory. And it's able to do that in some sense because, remember, we had to take n to be very large. So it's got a large number of degrees of freedom locally in it. But as I say, the field theory is living on Minkowski space, which we can think of as the boundary here. And then we have our fields in the bulk, let's take a field phi. And for every field in the bulk, there corresponds an operator in the quantum field theory. Maybe it's the stress tensor, maybe it's the Lagrangian, maybe it's, you know, whatever you like. But it's a whole derivatives of those things and so on. The key point then is that because this anti-de Sitter space acts like a box, you have to supply boundary conditions. If you were, imagine you were simulating just the dynamics of a scalar field in a box, you would have to say what the boundary value of the scalar field was on the box, the boundary of the box. And then once you've done that, you can simulate your theory and then ask, you know, what the solutions were. So the way this is done, the various fields in the bulk here have some expansion near this boundary, and the leading term, at least to be simplistic, the leading term you can think of as the sort of Dirichlet data that you want to fix to then make a consistent dynamical problem in the interior. And then the sort of sub-leading term in some sense is like the Neumann data. And just as with a box, if you simulated some field in a box, you might set the boundary values, you might evolve your field, and then you might ask, what does the, once you've got your solution, you can ask, for example, what does the normal gradient do at the boundary? That's something you would read off. And the same is true here. So you can specify this, which is a function of the coordinates here. You find your solution, and then you might read off this once you've already found your solution. Now, then there's a very pretty story, and the idea is that this boundary data that you fixed here, which is a function of the coordinates here, you should think of as a source for the operator in your field theory. So when you have a quantum field theory, one way to study it is by inserting sources into your partition function for various operators. And you can deform your theory by deforming the sources. And so the idea is that the partition function of the quantum field theory is the same, provided you add these sources for the operators, as the partition function for the gravity theory with this boundary condition. That's how the two theories are linked explicitly. And furthermore, this subleading data that you might read off once you found a solution actually gives you the vacuum expectation value, or the response to the source of the operator. It's actually a sort of very simple picture. And one can compute, there are prescriptions to compute higher order correlation functions, Wilson loops, and other more complicated things. But just to keep things simple, like that. Now, you can then perturb your theory in various ways. One way is by perturbing this source. So let's say time is running up here. So if we just make this source a function of time, we can, in some sense, inject some energy in. Let's just change the source as a function of time quickly. It injects some energy into this gravitational theory, which will have some dynamics. And then we might read off the vacuum expectation values of various operators in the field theory once we found the gravitational solution. And that would be telling us about the response of some strongly coupled quantum field theory to some time-dependent source, okay? Which is, from the point of view of field theory, a very hard problem. Another way of deforming the theory or perturbing it is just to not start in the vacuum state down here. You can start, for example, in a thermal state. And that is understood as putting a black hole into the interior here. So a black hole in the interior here, it looks like the geometry up here is the same. There's a boundary. But as you come down, you hit a horizon. So these are slightly odd black holes because the horizon isn't a sphere. It's like a planar horizon. It still has this planar geometry that Minkowski has. And black holes have a fascinating role. They are understood as regions where the conformal field theory is hot. So in some sense, when you solve what happens in the interior here, maybe we collide some energy, we form a black hole, the sort of shadow of that on the boundary is thought to describe the region of the quantum field theory, say this Yang-Mills theory, where you've heated up the plasma and it's come out of the vacuum and it's hot. And it's locally, just like a fluid, it's locally in equilibrium. There's some temperature locally. It may have some dynamics, but at least locally it's definitely hot. So black hole formation is linked to thermalization, which is a tremendously difficult thing to study in quantum field theory, but is rather straightforward to understand intuitively from the gravitational point of view. And also the various black hole solutions that you might have in this theory describe different thermal phases of your quantum field theory. Again, that's a hard question. And I would just say that actually it's understanding the phase structure of a theory, understanding the types of black holes, is actually a question that might be accessible from the quantum field theory directly using, for example, Monte Carlo simulation. That's being done for these types of theories. But understanding the dynamics of plasma ab initio in quantum field theory, in strongly coupled quantum field theory, is pretty much impossible. So, you know, being able to simulate a black hole here numerically is hard, but is not impossible. But, you know, it then is telling you something that essentially is incalculable from the point of view of the field theory. So anyway, so they're remarkable objects. Because we're in a theory that's rather exotic, sorry, and there are extra dimensions and so on, all of these exotic black holes we were talking about before, the black rings, black Saturns, and so on, inhomogeneous solutions, homogeneous localized solutions, they're all in ADS-CFT somewhere. So it's very complicated. It's even more complicated. There are even more exotic solutions. One of the applications of thinking about black holes has been to try and understand plasma physics, which is relevant for heavy iron experiments like Rick and Alice. And there's been a tremendous amount of work and a lot of interest there. And I won't talk about that because I haven't got time. Also, as I said, thermalization, tremendously difficult to understand from the quantum field theory point of view, particularly in strong coupling. And there was sort of very interesting numerical work essentially initiated by Cesare and Jaffe, also based on older ideas. And there have been lots of surprises in numerical work in the dynamics of thermalization from, for example, Bison and then the work of George Santos, Oscar Diaz, and Gary Horowitz. Surprising things can happen. Turbulent effects can happen in this gravitational theory, which is essentially arising because it's an exotic theory. These are effects that don't happen in normal 4D physics of black holes. And just finally, an application that's had quite a lot of interest is trying to understand rather exotic black holes when you have a dual gravity theory that has a vector field and a charged complex scalar. And these theories are thought to, they include black holes that when you turn on a chemical potential for the black hole, actually describe superconducting black holes. So they describe states in your theory where you have some charge density And that charge density can carry a superconducting current. Quite sort of very bizarre black holes, but actually they're not that difficult to find. It's a numerical problem to find them, but only a one-dimensional one. So it's essentially trivial, just Mathematica will do it. So this was work of Gupta and then later Hartnell, Horowitz, and Herzog. And the idea is that as you lower the temperature of the black hole, at some point this complex scalar wants to be non-zero. You want to have scalar hair, and so at some point, as you come down in temperature here, I've only drawn up to the critical value, but as you come down in temperature, suddenly the scalar field wants to turn on, and you have new sort of rather exotic black holes, and this is measuring the value of the scalar at the boundary, which gives you the BEV of some operator. And this effect is a sort of spontaneous symmetry breaking, because you had, it's a Higgs symmetry breaking effect. And in the dual field theory, this describes, again, a Higgs effect, which is the Higgs effect of superconductivity, the breaking of a U1 symmetry. And just finally, you know, one of the interesting things about, so it's very unclear in my mind, you know, these sort of superconducting materials that you might study from gravity, it's very unclear that anyone's going to build a metal or a fermion gas that has the properties that you have in these quantum field theories. So I think it's very far-fetched to imagine you're going to learn about real-world materials or anything that someone's going to build soon. But these are theories where you have something that superconducts. It's a strongly coupled quantum field theory that superconducts. And yet you have some sort of calculational control over it. And in particular, you have control over the dynamics of it. And there are superconductors in nature that are thought to be strongly coupled. They're not described by weak coupling physics. And there just aren't analytic tools to study them. And so these might not be the same as the material you have in your lab, but at least they're a strongly coupled material that you can at least do some calculations with. And so one of the things we were trying to look at is the dynamics of these theories, because dynamics is just so hard to do in the quantum field theory directly. One interesting thing is, well, can you look at the dynamics of these sort of black holes if you perturb them, if you knock them? In the context of condensed matter physics, the sort of state of the art is, I think, work by Barankov and Levitov and follow-up work, where they were trying to look at if you take a BCS superconductor and hit it, what does it do? And I'm working with some condensed matter colleagues on this. I'm no expert, so if you press me for details on these calculations, I'm simply going to have to refer you to them, and they're not here. So, but one of the things they found that was very interesting, there's a plot here that I don't really have time to explain. But roughly speaking, they have some parameter that describes how hard you hit the superconductor. And then their key result, in some sense, was to find three different behaviors. If you don't hit it very much, it stays a superconductor, but the amount of the condensate oscillates in time. There are oscillations. If you hit it quite a lot in this region here, it stays a superconductor, but it doesn't oscillate. It just settles down to the condensate value settles down to some amount. And if you really whack it, unsurprisingly, it stops being a superconductor. But there were lots of analytic approximations, and it's unclear, you know, the status of this calculation, how realistic. There are various important approximations made. But you can do the same thing with this holographic superconductor. You can turn on this source. You can throw in some energy. You can kick your superconductor by different amounts, by kicking it, by turning up the pulse of the source. It's just a 1+1 dimensional numerical GR simulation. So from the point of view of numerical GR, it's very trivial. And here's a plot of the scalar field in time versus radial distance, the horizon sort of here. You throw in everything static here. You throw in a pulse that has some response. You can read off the boundary behavior of VEVs. And in fact, you do see precisely the same sort of behavior as Barankov and Levitov saw in their analytic models. You see, if you don't kick it very much, this is the value of the condensate against time, sort of adjusts itself and oscillates. If you kick it quite a lot, it doesn't go away, but it doesn't oscillate. And if you kick it a lot, it just decays to zero exponentially.
Which way do you kick it?
So we kick it by turning on. So now we're going to get technical. So we kick it by turning on a source for the scalar. So essentially, it's the source for the order parameter. So we're using this bottom-up model of the Hartnell-Horowitz and Herzog. And in fact, in that model, the only thing you can kick it with is a source for the scalar and the bulk.
How do they kick it?
Oh, sorry, how do they kick it?
Yeah.
They kick it by changing a pairing interaction for the... So, you know, in the BCS theory, you have a condensation into sort of singlets, and they kick, they change the pairing interaction that controls that. They make it a function of time, and yet they can still solve. So instead of just looking at the sort of BCS state, they can find the time-dependent generalization of it, at least under certain approximations. So let me end there. Let me just say that, you know, so it's interesting you see the same behavior, even though this is a theory where the different approximations were made. And I should also say this structure of oscillations and not oscillations can be understood in terms of quasi-normal modes of the black hole, which is something we understand well in gravity. So just in summary, there's a very rich, I've run a few minutes over there, it's a very rich phenomenology if you consider, for example, extra dimensions or modifications of gravity, and really rather little is known. Rather little is known about black holes in extra dimensions if you're worried about collider physics. Rather, very, very little is known about black holes in sort of modified theories of gravity, and they do potentially provide a window to test these exotic theories. And in the role of ADS-CFT, black holes play a very privileged role, and really, they're even more complicated. The structure of black holes is even more complicated than the stuff that happens up here, just because the theories are so exotic, the boundary conditions, they have extra dimensions, everything. And many of the questions that you would never think to ask for black holes then become quite interesting when you think about what they mean in the quantum field theory. And almost the trick is understanding what the interesting questions are. So there may be many relatively straightforward problems that are actually quite interesting, rather than from the black hole side of things, many hard problems that aren't so interesting for the field theorists. So I've gone over time, so thank you for your attention.
This is a question that I'm always curious about. In the correspondence between bulk black holes and thermal states with informal field theory, you make use of positive specific heat black holes because the thermal states of a quantum field theory are going to have positive specific heat.
Yeah.
And those are exotic large black holes from the traditional point of view.
Yeah.
But using your numerical methods, can you probe what the dual of a black hole with negative specific heat would be? In the conformal field theory, which is something that goes beyond the standard correspondence.
Sorry, which numerical methods? It's finding the black holes themselves. So, for example, if you take global ADS, we analytically know both the large black hole solutions and the small hole solutions.
Classically.
Yeah. Classically.
Right.
Oh, so you're then talking about if you were trying to simulate the, if you're actually trying to study the field theory.
The question is, what is the... So when the black hole has positive specific heat, there's a good argument that it's dual is the thermal state of the quantum field theory on the boundary.
Yeah.
Okay. But if the black hole has negative specific heat, it can't have such a simple dual description. So what can you do something that probes what the dual description would be?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think the dual description would be that if, say, you're working in the canonical ensemble, so for example in global ADS, there are these two types of solution. I think the description would be that there would be unstable saddle points of the partition, the canonical partition function for the CFT.
Well, that's in some sense what it has to be, but can you say more than that? Can that be really investigated?
Well, I think it's difficult to say, because it's strongly coupled, it's difficult to say much about the stable saddle points of the partition function.
Right,
but the fact
that there's a simple description on the bulk side suggest there might be some phenomenon in the conformal field theory to do for that.
Sorry, that's what I meant. In the conformal field theory, it's an unstable saddle point of the conformal field theory's partition function.
But it might be that there's some simple behavior that could be characterized using, probing numerically with probing perturbations of the negative specific heat black holes.
I see. Yeah, I'm not sure.
In the bulk, it's just a Hawking page transition. Right, so you compare the free energy of both solutions, and you just see that it stops being dual to a large black hole, and it starts being dual to ADS at a certain temperature with the gas of Trebizond. So I don't really understand your question.
But what if you just start with a particle which is small in the ball and has
the canonical ensemble.
Oh, yeah. So,
the point is there's no canonical.
Yeah, so if you think about the dynamic, in some sense, the microcanonical ensemble, you would start with a small black hole. And it would indeed be, it presumably would be a metastable state in the CFT. So in the limit that n becomes large, you turn off the Hawking radiation effect.
Right.
So in the limit that you make n finite, what would happen if n is large but finite, this small black hole will be metastable for a long time controlled by n, but eventually it will evaporate into radiation. I mean, I think that's the picture one would understand. But as I say, I think, understanding it ab initio in the field theory is hard.
Can you comment on the issue of static versus dynamic solutions in Randall syndrome? I mean, you found in your numerics that they are actually static solutions. Is there some nice physical intuition that tells you that
should
be the case?
The physical, well, I don't know if it's physical or not.
Yeah.
In some sense, I think the physical intuition, if you just looked at the model, would be probably there's a static solution. But the intuition that there wasn't goes something like this. You can substitute the Randall syndrome model when you look at large black holes. You can relate rather precisely to solutions in ADS CFT, where you make the where instead of taking the field theory to live on Minkowski space, you make it live on the Schwarzschild solution. And then you can rephrase the problems. You can say, supposing I consider ADS CFT where I think about the CFT on Schwarzschild, just fixed Schwarzschild background. So we're just doing curved space quantum field theory. Mm-hmm. Does the stress tensor, the quantum stress tensor for that theory, radiate energy, essentially Hawking radiate energy, at leading order in n, okay, which is where the gravity is, what the gravity is describing. And the naive expectation is something like this, that it's a Yang-Mills theory, it's made up of gluons, there are n squared degrees of freedom, so you just take the Hawking result and multiply it by n squared, and you indeed will expect there to be an n squared flux of energy radiating away from this black hole in this strongly coupled theory. And what actually seems to happen is that you don't get a flux of radiation, because it's strongly coupled. The strong coupling in some sense is an attractive strong coupling that basically stops the radiation radiating out. You do generate a sort of halo of plasma, but it's not a flux. It's not a flux of energy. It's just a static halo of plasma, and that actually, So why that is true, we're not quite sure. But that is essentially it's the reason that happens is the fact that static black holes and Randall syndrome exist. So it's related to the rather strange properties of this conformal field there is in ADS CFT. We would like to understand better.
So I wanted to follow up on Lee's question
in
the context of this Bizon stuff. Because the usual interpretation that people give, so as you know, in the Bizon stuff, you take initial data, no matter how small, and eventually you form a black hole.
Mm.
And what people usually say about that is, oh yes, it's obvious in the conformal field theory side of things, you're confining things to an S3, and so sure, eventually if you wait long enough, things must come to thermal equilibrium. But the Bizon data is really for small black holes. So if small black holes don't really represent thermal equilibrium, then how are we supposed to understand what the Bizon result means on the conformal field theory side?
Yeah, I mean, so for those who don't know, so Pyotr Bizon had a very nice result where he took ADS different to how I've described it in global coordinates. So the field theory is now living on a sphere rather than flat space. And he showed that actually, normally when you have a gravitational theory and you think about gravitational collapse, you have to put in a certain amount of energy in some sense into your initial matter in order for it to collapse to form a black hole. So there's a critical phenomena. If you just put in a tiny bit of energy, the matter just disperses. It doesn't form a black hole. Whereas if in ADS, it seems rather surprisingly that any amount of energy will always form a black hole eventually. It might not sort of form on the first pass, but because ADS is like a box, it will travel in, maybe disperse through itself, but then bounce back, and there's a focusing of energy, and eventually it will form a black hole. And so the dual description of that, as David was saying, is presumably that in this conformal field theory on a sphere, any amount of energy, it can't really escape. Energy can't escape if you're on a sphere, so if you put any amount of energy, any perturbation in, you will inevitably form a black hole. Now, that is just the first stage in the thermalization process, presumably, because exactly as you say, this is a small black hole and it will evaporate. So there are different dynamical timescales. There's this classical gravity timescale where you form the black hole, which is what Bizon's studying, and then there's another timescale after where it evaporates. And in fact, there may be a region in between here where you form the black holes, then they do something crazy, some crazy dynamics. Maybe they coalesce with each other to form slightly bigger black holes. Maybe the energy all rearranges itself into a single black hole. And then you have to wait a different time scale controlled by n, which is sort of infinite in the gravity limit, for that to then evaporate into a sort of thermal gas of gravitons, which would presumably be the final end state. And what's interesting, really, is that there's a separation in time scales in the thermalization. There's some complicated dynamics that happens rather fast, and then there's the sort of more standard dynamics of evaporation of the black hole. I'm not sure if that's fully answers your question, but...
At least I understand more than I did before, so thank you.
But, you know, I mean, I think not much is understood about these things. You know, from the CFT point of view, I think it's all very well to say it's obvious what happens, but I think it's far from obvious what happens. It's obvious what happens if you see that the obvious result is happening. But it is worth emphasizing that, you know, these field theories are a little bit peculiar. So, you know.
I guess there are no further questions. Let's take this topic again.